you guys can start talking whatever you feel the need to.
Yeah.
Well, as for the, excuse me, the need to speak, well, all I was going to do is let's start. Back here with Chris Tannehill and Derek Townsend one more time. And the reason we're coming back to you folks is our favorite topic. Well, used to be alcohol. And we wanted to talk a little bit about that. And but what I wanted to do is ask Derek, and let's do this in reverse order. Derek, what is your life like today? What's going on?
I've got, you know, a little over 3 years, you know, 3 years sober. You know, I've got a steady job. I've got my own place. I've got structure. I've got stability. I've got financial security. You know, I've got a good woman in my life. I've got my family back in my life. I've got great relationships with my mother, my grandmother. You know, I'm a person who shows up to work. I can be relied on for things. You know, I'm being promoted at work. I've just got it. My life is not how it was, you know, 3 short years ago. You know, I'm involved in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm involved in a community of people that, you know, without, I wouldn't have the life I have today. You know, I work with sponsees. I've got a sponsor. I do 3 meetings a week. I do a panel a week, you know, still 3 years into this thing. I'm very much involved in AA. And without that, I wouldn't have this life. But on the flip side of that, I do still struggle from depression, you know, and anxiety. And, you know, I still have those things going on, and what that stems from, you know, I couldn't pinpoint it, you know, unresolved issues, old resentments, guilt, shame, fear, fear of success, fear of failure, fear of love, fear of, you know, abandonment, fear of, you know, being loved, you know, fear of commitment. You know, there's a lot of things that go along with that, but I think a lot of that is just, you know, human nature and, you know, being sober these days, I just have the ability to learn how to cope with these things in a healthy way. You know, it's all the same feelings I used to have before, you know, but I get to feel them today. You know, when I have a problem, I don't numb. When I have a problem, I don't run away. When I have a problem, I find the best route to go about to fixing it and in a way that's least harmful to myself and others.
Here, let's just stop for 1 second right there. You know, you just, that's what's going on today. No, let's not go all the way back into it. Let's back up the clock till about 1 month after you got sober.
One month after I got sober.
Describe that.
Still very selfish and self-centered. I was just getting out of treatment for the fourth time and was given I'd like to say my decision to go to sober living, but in reality, I had nowhere else to go. You know, my ex-wife didn't want me back. My family didn't want me back. Nobody wanted to be around me, and I kind of had to make do and figure out what I was going to do going forward. And there was a lot of, it was mixed emotions. There's a lot of fear, but there was a lot of excitement. You know, because in my mind, I'm still avoiding responsibility. You know, I'm going to stay in a sober living. You know, I don't have to go back to my job quite yet. You know, financially, I'm taken care of because I've got great insurance. You know, I there wasn't a whole lot of what's the best word I can use for this? I don't know if I could, for lack of a better word, I wasn't scared. You know, I wasn't scared of the future for once. And that was kind of my attitude going into any of my treatment centers, was I get to escape responsibility and avoid responsibility. And hopefully the people that are in my life will eventually allow me to play that victim role to the point where I get to weed my way back into their lives. And you know, fortunately for me, it didn't happen that way this time. You know, so 30 days in, I was jumping into sober living and was told to do a couple things, which was get a sponsor, get a home group and keep that sobriety date. And I didn't think much of it. And I just started doing it. And So I'm 40 months later, still doing it.
Okay. You've got that. Now, let's wind the clock. Let's just wind it back up to the treatment center prior to that. Tell us that experience.
That one was in which one was that?
You must be the real deal. Anyone who goes, which one was that?
Yeah, no, I think that was because I came out here in November 2015, and I want to say I was at the Meadows in Wickenburg, Arizona, the summer of 2015.
Okay.
That would have been my second time at that facility, my second birthday in a row at that facility. And, you know, same attitude, like I just said, you know, it was very much the escape, you know, stressed out from work, stressed out from life, stressed out from the wife, stressed out from financial, stressed out from family nagging and people not allowing me to live my life the way I want to, you know, this is my escape to go get medicated, get three meals a day and feel right. So I could go back and figure out how to do it all over again.
Why did that trip fail in your best assumption and or presumption?
Well, there's probably a few variables to that, but the one I can think of is I didn't want to get sober.
Okay.
I didn't want to stop drinking.
That's a good answer.
And somebody that doesn't want to get sober, that's, you know, gets placed back into old situations surrounded by old people and old job and old behaviors and old environments. And it, you know, I didn't last a day. You know, I got back and, you know, I think I put on a good face for that afternoon and went to sleep and woke up the next day and went to the liquor store and bought a pint.
You know? My man. No, that's my man right there. That makes sense to me. The let's back the clock up now to before your first treatment center and just your relationship to alcohol and
okay, so that's about 2 years.
Okay.
Well, 2 years prior to getting sober.
Yeah.
So how my life was. Wow. So, you know, being the career field that I was in and what I was doing and
having success at it too.
It was somewhat success, but towards the end it was just, you know, I was full of shit, you know. I wasn't the cook I used to be, or I didn't have the attitude or the passion or the love for it anymore. You know, it just became a job, and it just became a job I could drink at. But just the physical aspects of it, you know, it was no longer something I look forward to doing, you know, on the weekends or in the evenings after work, you know, to wind down. It just became something that I was doing, you know, for every waking minute of the day. You know, the only time I wasn't drinking is when I was sleeping. And when I was sleeping, I'd go into detox and withdrawal. And when I'd wake up, you know, and I'd feel that pit in the center of my chest, and it would start spreading throughout my body, and I'd start feeling it in my fingers and my toes. And I knew a panic attack or anxiety was about to come on. And I remember that feeling. Because every time I get that feeling, I want to die, you know, and I want to jump out of my skin. And the only solution for me is the booze, you know. And I'd run downstairs to the fridge and or the freezer or the cabinet or the laundry basket or the truck or wherever I happened to have alcohol available. And, you know, I'd pour however many fingers I could get into the glass. And whatever was in the fridge, you change the color of that vodka, and I'd put the bowl in the sink and just pray that, you know, the alcohol would stay down. And mind you, this is 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning. Mm-hmm. And some mornings it would stay down, and that would be a fucking breath of fresh air. It would be a relief, you know.
Speaking of relief, was that the only relief you're getting?
That was the only relief I had in my life, you know. And then some other mornings, you know, the alcohol would come back up and it would go straight into that bowl, and whatever was in the bowl went back into the cup, and I'd drink that, you know, because I didn't waste anything,
mm-hmm.
you know. And that's just basically where my life had taken me, and it was rinse and repeat from there.
Okay, so that makes sense to me. And for the folks out there that don't have much experience with this, and there's either they do or they don't, but let's talk about how long you've had that relationship with alcohol at that intensity level.
10 years. You know, I started drinking, you know, heavily at around 19, but didn't get real serious until my mid-20s.
Why? Is there a reason for that or just progression?
Progression. And what I did for work, it was just accepted, and people – again, it's who you surround yourself with. You know, I surrounded myself with other cooks and drunks and alcoholics. So my behavior was normalized. You know, I looked at other people, and there was always somebody worse than me.
People always forget to ask this question. Did you have fun sometimes?
I had a lot of fun.
Here we go.
I had a blast.
So did I.
It was a lot of fun until it wasn't.
Until it wasn't. And then you can't stop. Can you describe for people what it's like? Because this, the argument that alcoholism is a disease, not a disease. I mean, we can talk about that all day, and we will. But the point is that there's a point where there's absolutely no choice. And the, what I mean
by
that
is less of a disease and more of a necessity.
Okay.
You know, it was the only thing I knew. You know, and I'd convinced myself for so long that this is the only thing that works for me. You know, and I got to a point where I wasn't willing to go through the pain to get to the other side. So I just continued to do what I was doing because that's what I do.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think that's the simplicity of it. You know, sure, I had a bunch of childhood trauma and, you know, there's sexual abuse and physical abuse and emotional abuse as a kid, but that's not why I drank and used. I drank and used because I liked the way it made me feel.
Excuse me. Oh, pardon me. The alcoholism. Let's back up before that 10-year streak started.
All right.
Describe your relationship to alcohol and or anything, or to Derek at that point even. First off, how about how old are you?
The 10 years prior, I mean, I was 24.
Okay.
You know, it was it's about the time I stopped using cocaine. So I kind of correlate the two to, like, I use cocaine to drink more.
Yeah.
And I stopped using cocaine and I continued to drink like I was on cocaine.
Wow.
And then that's kind of where the blackouts came and all that fun shit. So, I guess you could pinpoint to when I gave myself to alcohol, and that was it. You know,
do you remember how that felt?
I thought I was doing the right thing.
Yeah.
Because, you know, it's accepted. You know, I can go buy it. You know, my parents drink, my family drinks, my friends drink, my friends' parents drink, you know, people on TV drink, the people at the bars drink, you know, you go to sporting events, you drink, you go to concerts, you drink. You know, it was just, it was there. So
your statement that I gave myself to alcohol, because I something clicked inside of me when you said that, because my experience was, oh, I'm free. Yeah. Finally, you know, and wow, that's worst little dungeon I ever put myself into.
Yeah, it was. But again, I didn't know how else to live. But then again, I didn't want to know how else to live, because that's just the life I had going for me. I mean, it was just it was just all around me.
Okay.
You know, and it was just part of the lifestyle.
That makes sense. Let's back up 10 more years. Let's back up 10 more years. Now what are we dealing with?
Mushrooms. I mean, that alcohol
is a progression, not always a logical progression, but it's a progression.
There's a lot of vomiting and experimenting with alcohol. I mean, it wasn't something that I did. I mean, again, I was 14 at that point, so it wasn't like I could go to the store. I wasn't surrounding myself with people that were drinking all the time. You know, it was just whatever we could sneak out of the cabinets and things of that nature, or go to your buddy's house when you know their parents are out of town or things like that.
Did you notice you were different at that point, or did you notice at all?
I noticed I didn't stop when I started.
Did you know how much you were going to consume when you got going?
Enough.
Sounds symptomatic of a couple of things there. If we back it up a little bit.
I like the way that people responded to me when I drank as a kid. As my sponsor will tell me, my first addiction was approval.
Okay, I was going to say, what does that look like? So you're saying it's approval.
Yeah, you know, I wanted to be accepted. You know, I was an only child that grew up in broken homes, you know, and my parents were trying to recreate lives for themselves, and I was trying to find out where I fit into those lives. So, you know, when I found people, you know, I was trying to be accepted. Mm-hmm. And when I drank, whether it was good attention or bad attention, it was attention nonetheless.
Yeah.
And whether I was passed out or throwing up, or people were paying attention to me, or I was the funny guy that was making everybody laugh, you know, I got attention, and that's what I thrived on.
If I back the clock up
till I was four?
Yeah. Let's back it up to your four. Can we see anything? Can we see something coming? Or do you feel something coming? Maybe 5, 6 years old?
I bounced around so much as a kid. You know, both of my parents were married and divorced 4 times before I was 10.
So internally is already turmoil.
Yeah. I mean, I'm between, you know, both of my parents, step parents, you know, step siblings, you know, I was just the pass around.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I don't think it was malicious. I think that they were just too busy trying to
Oh, I get it.
To build their lives. And then I was just kind of there.
No, I, you know, there's a great picture of me when I'm two years old with a beer. You get your own beer, you know, and there's a nice snapshot in the family album for that. You know, now it's a CPS case, you know. Back then it was just, Tuesday.
And both my parents are workaholics. You know, it's like my grandmother did most of my raising. So, yeah.
You have any family history that would explain some of your...
I can't diagnose anybody, but my family drank a lot, you know. My dad stopped drinking probably when I was about 13 or 14. He just stopped, but still acted, you know, poorly, alcoholically, if you will.
So this predisposition you have for alcohol, does anyone else in your family have it other than maybe your father?
My mom drinks, my grandfather drank, my grandmother didn't drink, my uncles like to drink, but everybody's kind of got, you know, they've all got their shit together.
Okay.
You know, so we could have the conversation of, you know, is it nature or nurture? Is it genetic or, you know, environmental?
Yeah.
You know, is it something you grow up with and you see, so you emulate, or is it something that's just ingrained in your body you're destined to be an alcoholic? I don't know, because I've seen both cases.
Yeah. Now, so I've met a couple of people that worked in and around alcohol their entire lives with no family history that became alcoholic.
Right.
Whereas I've seen other people with a complete alcoholic gene ready to go, never been exposed to alcohol long enough to trip over it. And
right.
They, you know, they don't go there. So it's astounding. The medical case for anyone who happens to stumble across this this podcast, God bless you. Can't believe you're still listening to us. But hey, guess what? Here's your fun argument, folks. If someone says, oh, it's not a disease. Well, we have many arguments for that. But right now, the insurance company is paying for it. And if it wasn't a disease, they'd never pay for it. There's your easiest argument in history.
Right.
Number two, brain disease. Chemicals in the brain do get altered. They do get altered and change. The behavioral aspect of it, we're going to talk about that maybe in a little bit, maybe in the next podcast. But the point is, this is a progressive brain disease. And when it gets a hold of you... I'll tell you what, the idea that I had no choice, back to the power of choice was removed, and someone's like, oh, you had no choice, so you weren't responsible for your... No, I'm responsible for every action I ever took. I wasn't responsible for craving the alcohol. I craved it when I was 5, 6 years old. I remember craving it, then putting it in front of me getting some, and then getting cut off at like a full family dinner. And I remember craving alcohol. I'm not responsible for that. Everything else, that's all me. Blackouts, like you discussed, me. So and we'll touch on a bit more of that. I just wanted to throw that little dart out there. But now we've got this picture of Derek, and we back that up, and we've seen, you know, we've just done this, like you said, in reverse order here. I won't ask you if you'd ever do anything differently, but let me ask you this. Now that you're working in treatment, how do you see alcoholism, patients, sickness? Because these behaviors these folks have, some of them are just pretty horrendous. And I'll tell you what, getting around that, people, you know, eventually get caught being themselves, you know.
Well, initially it's like, oh, shit, is that how I acted? You know, seeing people that come into treatment, you know, right off the plane, or, you know, seeing people go into detox. And it's not necessarily like the really bad behavior that I did when I was, you know, drinking, but it's, you know, how I treated people around me when I wasn't drinking. Is kind of what I pay attention to, because that's, I think, when I was at my worst, is when I didn't have my substance, and how I reacted towards people when I didn't get what I wanted, you know, and how I acted sober, which is few and far between and rare. But, you know, when I was trying to get sober around my ex-wife and seeing how I treated that relationship and see how I treated my mother and how I treated those things. So those are the things that I kind of pay attention to, like watching patients speak to their families and you know, listening to the conversations they have and how they treat other people and how they try and manipulate and being aware of those behaviors and seeing how those things come together. And going, shit, I was exactly like that. So it kind of works for me to be in treatment, because I understand. And I think that's the thing that keeps me in treatment, is I get it. You know, I'm one of them, and they're one of me, you know, and they're my people. And, you know, I think that's you need that to be able to be successful in treatment, and not successful financially, but to continue to do it. you know, to continue to have that drive to want to help somebody that you saw, you know, that was in your position and felt the same things that you felt, and try and give them a little bit of hope, you know.
The I've got nothing but family in AA, right. You know. I actually almost had a lucky streak. I almost had a bit of success in AA before I ended up at Betty Ford Center outpatient, and they helped me get back to AA. Hi. You know, and thank God I got scholarshiped, or, you know, I would have had to pay money to get sent to AA is the joke.
So you grew up with AA.
I grew up with AA. And
so the stigma of AA was different for you.
Wasn't a big deal. Right. I knew there was a place to go. I just didn't realize the price that you have to pay to do some of this, you know? And, you know, I think my question is, what do you think of treatment today? I mean, because people say, oh, it's BS, it's necessary. What do you think of treatment? Let me just put it that way, as a counselor.
The simple answer is you get what you put into it. But the more complicated one is, or the more, I guess, more complicated response would be, you know, it's kind of got to be the perfect storm of where your life is and where the wreckage is and what's going on to make you want to get better. Is the pain enough to where you feel you need to make a change? And what does that look like for you? You know, what else needs to happen in your life? You know, what do you want to allow to happen to your life? You know, how many yets do you want to tack on before you finally go, okay, this has gone too far. You know, and hopefully the pain doesn't kill you before it happens.
How many times did you try to stop sincerely when you said, okay, this hurts enough, I'm done, but we're unable to?
I think there was a good period where I tried to stop every day, every morning. I didn't want to drink. Yeah. It gotten to the point where I didn't enjoy it. It wasn't something that I looked forward to doing. It was just the only thing that made me feel okay.
So you're doing that against
your own will. I didn't feel great.
Will.
You know, I didn't feel elated. It wasn't a joyous thing anymore. It wasn't, you know, it was just the only thing that made me feel okay.
Do you think treatment's necessary?
I think detox is necessary.
That's a great statement.
I think, you know, trying to do this shit on your own is, it'll kill you.
Yeah.
Treatment, you know, AA does a great job.
A lot of non-professionals there.
Yeah.
I met a couple.
Yeah.
I am one of them.
I mean, I think the dual diagnosis is necessary. You know, I mean, if there's mental health issues that go along with the substance abuse, absolutely, you know, getting to the root of those things and connecting with trauma and realizing why you picked up to begin with, you know, trying to get that nailed down.
Yeah.
I think that's necessary. I think going through life and just suppressing emotions and feelings and experiences just because you don't want to deal with how they feel is dangerous. You know, but just, you know, but detox needs to happen first.
Yeah.
But you got to want to. That's
no, you
the
do.
Thing. You got to want it.
What was the statement? That listen, somebody who wants help, you know what? Shit. You know, if they want help, nothing can stop them.
Right.
But if they don't want help, no one can help them.
Yeah.
You know, there's no chance. And yeah, like you said, what does it take to arrive there? If there was some program and or format in which we could introduce an accelerated, yeah.
Oh,
you know.
And then being from the outside looking in and being a parent or family member. It's like, have you ever fallen in love with somebody that doesn't love themselves? You know, and it's not, I was thinking about that on the car ride over, you know. It's like, have you ever tried to love somebody that doesn't love themselves? And I don't know how you try to love somebody. Either do or you don't, you know. It's like, have you ever fallen in love with somebody that doesn't love themselves and the pain that comes along with watching that person deteriorate, you know, and being sober and having that clarity and experiencing that, you know, falling in love with somebody who doesn't want to stay sober and continues to use and continues to throw themselves out there and continues to overdose and continues to try and kill themselves. Like, that's horrendous. That is one of the worst things I've ever been through. So being on the outside looking in now is another big motivator to continue to help, I guess, or reach out.
Some of the most insane stuff I've seen is family.
It's
family
tough.
Group, family, when they come, and then you've got the addict alcoholic there and they're starting to get better. Family, Not so much sometimes. That gets exciting.
Well, that was, you know, my biggest thing. And just because I'm ready to get back into life doesn't mean that life's ready for me, you know, and just because I've got, you know, 60 days clean, you know, and I want to start making amends and start and say sorry for all the shit, you know, and get back to work and get back to life. Life's not ready for me yet, you know, because unfortunately they know better, you know, and that was, I think, one of the biggest things that kept me sober is I disconnected from everything that was wreckage and everything that was old behavior and past, you know, and nothing changes if nothing changes. I had to start fresh.
Anyway, what we'll do is we're going to talk a bit more about alcoholism the next go around, but I did want to mention one thing, that they have a stat that came out with each year saying, hey, this many people died of, you know, opioid or just narcotic overdose, just pick a drug. And it's gone up every year. I mean, I remember when I started teaching, it was, I don't know, 38,000, and now it's got like 64. Now it's creeping into the 70s. What's amazing is alcohol is still killing 88,000 people per year in America. Absolutely. America, like, easily, with, you know, it's still in the lead. You'd think after all the opioid stuff, you'd hear that the opioids and or other drugs, you know, combined would be in the lead. Not yet. Alcohol, our legal, dangerous gateway drug, is
drive through liquor stores.
Drive through liquor. Here it is. You know, it's we got more to say about this, but we'll say it at another time. But Derek, I just want to say thank you again.
Yeah, you're very welcome.
Much appreciated. And from one drunk to another, and thank our producer, Mr. Eric. Thank you, sir. All right. All right.